If you read this whole chapter, you'll find that Sri Aurobindo explains to us the nature of the divine. The whole chapter is actually could have been described as nature of the divine. How is the divine himself the Shastra? Divine himself as a Shastra. The divine himself as a divine knowledge. The divine knowledge of the process by which one can enter into relationship with the divine. The divine himself as the effort. The divine himself as a laborer. The divine himself as a pupil, as a student. And how the divine relates himself with the student as a student and as a teacher. And now we have the divine himself as the divine teacher. And if you look upon the divine, divine can be looked upon in many different ways. He can be looked upon as the Lord of the universe. He can be looked upon as one who upholds the universe, not the Lord, but upholds the universe. The divine as the enjoyer of the universe. One who plays with the universe as the player. The divine can be seen as one who is indifferent to the universe. He is so above the universe that universe is simply a small play in his one fingertip. The divine can be seen as one who is turning the wheel of the universe in which all the human beings are like the cogs of the machine. But the divine can also be seen as our teacher. And here we have the description of him as our teacher. As our teacher, he is first a veiled master, a master who is not seen by us. And yet who is working with us and above us as the instructor. How does he instruct? By what he is veiled? What is it that veils him? Why is he not seen as a teacher? And Sri Aurobindo answers in the very first line on page 56 in the new paragraph that we are going to read. This inner guide is often veiled at first by the very intensity of our personal effort and by the ego's preoccupation with itself and its aims. Because we are laboring too much and because we are preoccupied with our own petty aims of life, that the great master who is behind remains veiled from us. We do not have as yet questioning in our mind. We behave as if we know the answers to the questions. We labor as if we know what we have to do, what we must do, what we want to do. And unless we ask questions, the teacher doesn't unveil himself. The first task that we should have with our teacher is to go with a bag of questions. Unless we have questions, the teacher doesn't reveal himself. So long as we know what we have to do, Most of us know what we have to do. Although, in our quiet moments, we admit, oh, I don't know who I am. I don't know what is my life. I don't know what I have to do in my life. In our quieter moments, we do all that. But in our active life, we behave as if we know what we want to do. Somebody says something, we know how to react to it immediately. We know how to become angry, we know how to be displeased, we know how to be pleased, how to welcome. We know everything, as it were, all that is needed in our life. And because of this knowledge, which is ignorance, the divine teacher is veiled. In the Bhagavad Gita it is said, if you want to go to the teacher, you should go with pariprashnena. You should have repeated questioning. Sevaya. And you should serve the teacher. These are the two methods of approaching the teacher. By repeated questioning, when you begin to suspect that we are ignorant, which you don't normally do, but when you begin to suspect that we do not know, then the questions arise. And then the attitude develops in us of serving the teacher. Pariprashnena sevaya. Sevaya means by means of seva, of service. Pariprashnena means repeated question, not only prashna. Pariprashnena. Repeated questioning. Again and again, you question. That is why in the Indian system there is always a beginning of studies which says, Atha Brahma Jigyasa. Now is the query, the desire to know the Brahman, the Divine. So the Master is to be known, to be, in order to receive instruction, we have to know Him. The more we question Him, the more unveiled He becomes. The more we receive the answers from Him, the greater becomes our occupations, not with ourselves, but with Him. The inner guide is often veiled at first by the very intensity of our personal efforts and by the ego's preoccupation with itself and its aims. As we gain in clarity and the turmoil of egoistic effort gives place to a calmer self-knowledge, we recognize the source of the growing light within us. The growing light within us. Yesterday, I began to speak to you, day before yesterday, began to speak to you of the knowledge. What is knowledge? It was just an introduction to the idea of knowledge. But a greater understanding of knowledge comes when we consider the contrast between knowledge and information. As I said last time, all knowledge is uncovering. And the uncovering is done in many ways. Word, I told you, is a way of uncovering. You hear a word, and the word uncovers. Idea is presented, and idea can be seen as a ray of light. It also uncovers. Another way of uncovering is to gain information. In fact, information to our present day is so important that to us all information is knowledge and all knowledge is information. As if there is nothing else than information. It is only when we come to deeper levels of understanding that we find that true knowledge is far transcendental of information. To get the information about soul is not soul knowledge. You read 10 books on the descriptions of the soul and you find you were exactly where you were almost. You may read 10 books about the knowledge of God. It is information about God, but that is not God knowledge. Even with the world, we have much information, but truly to know the world, unless you become one with the world, there is knowledge by identity, you do not know the world. You may have information, I know who is my uncle, who is my father, who is my mother, but you do not know. Knowledge is having a different dimension. The true knowledge has three characteristics. There is first a growth of light. There is something like what we can call illumination. The least level of experience of illumination is awakening. One is awakened. In the Veda, it was termed as the arrival of Usha, the arrival of dawn. We may have a lot of information, but there is no arrival of Usha in it. There is no awakening. That is the first mark. There is awakening. The whole world then seems to be different. The ones you are awake, it is like dreaming and coming to a state of awakening. What is the difference between the two? That's the first mark. Is the arrival of the glow of light. There is a shock. And we find the world is not what we thought it to be. It's not the humdrum of existence. There are depths and depths and heights and heights. Even this knowledge, this awakening to heights and depths and widenesses. In fact, all true education begins with the perception of wideness, of depth, and of heights. These three words are very important in all process of education. As you are educating yourself, you must ask always these three questions. How wide have I become? How deep have I become? How high I have become? These are the three measures by which you can judge yourself, evaluate yourself in the true process of knowledge. With the awakening, the deepening, widening, heightening, these three processes begin to occur. When you begin to experience these three things, you are entering into the threshold of knowledge. Even information can give you these three things. When you are informed about many things, you experience to some extent this heightening, widening, and deepening. But when you are truly awakened, you begin to perceive the widenesses. You don't merely see the shadows of widenesses or of deepening depths or of the heights. It's like hearing Himalaya is the highest mountain. It is information about Himalayas. And then you go and stand before the Himalayas and really see the glory in the daylight of the snow peaks of the Himalayas. The heights and heights, the rocks piled upon piles. then you begin to perceive the heights of the Himalayas and become overwhelmed by it. But that is only the beginning. Then there is the growth of the being. Information gives you growth of becoming. The true knowledge gives you growth of being. And there's a difference between growth of becoming and growth of being. The more you know through information, the more you can deal with the world externally, which is good by itself. But it is not true knowledge. You grow into the being. What is the difference between becoming and being? Being is the source of becoming. That's the first difference. Being is a source of becoming. In the process of becoming, you fluctuate. It's like the flow of the river. There is a wavy movement. In the process of being, you stabilize yourself. There's an experience of stability. You become sthanu. That is the Sanskrit word. Sthanu. You become stable. You become unshakable mountain. An experience of possessing yourself. Self-possession. When you possess in your palm something, and when you see a thing outside you, this is the difference between information and knowledge. When you have information, you only stand before an object. But in the knowledge, you possess the object of knowledge. There is self-possession. And then there is self-mastery. That is the third stage of true knowledge, self-mastery, in which you find all that is to be known as contained in it. It's not only that you possess in your hands or only a little thing, but you possess, you contain, not only possess, but you contain within yourself. And the divine teacher is interested in this task, in developing your being. So, as Sri Aurobindo says, as we gain in clarity, and as the turmoil of egoistic effort gives place to a calmer self-knowledge, we recognize the source of the growing light within us. We recognize it retrospectively as we realize how all our obscure and conflicting movements have been determined towards an end that you only now begin to perceive. How even before our entrance into the path of the yoga, the evolution of our life has been designedly led towards its turning point. This is the experience of all who stand at the threshold of the true knowledge. As you stand at the threshold of yoga, and you become awake to the necessity of yoga in your life, you realize how the Divine Himself was leading you towards that path, even without your knowledge, even without your consent. All circumstances of life were determined, as it were, so as to make you aware of the need of yoga. You recognize it retrospectively. You have already trodden the path to some extent, then you look back retrospectively, and then you come to know, oh, this was the meaning of it. As Sri Aurobindo was taken to the Alipur jail, and he asked the question, why am I taken to this jail? He was removed from the field of his work in which he was fully engaged. And he was cut suddenly from all that surrounding that field of action and put into a prison where he cannot meet even a single person apart from himself, apart from the sentries. Then, retrospectively, when he began to lead the life in Alipur jail, as he began to contemplate and meditate on the Gita, on the Upanishads, and when he heard the Supreme Lord himself, Sri Krishna, telling him, there is a big work to be done. You have to tread a path of yoga. And a new path of yoga has to be created for mankind. When he came to learn this, then retrospectively he understood why he was taken to the jail. It is retrospective. It is the Lord himself, as a master, as a teacher. So we recognize it retrospectively as we realize how all our obscure and conflicting movements have been determined towards an end that we only now know, now begin to perceive. How even before our entrance into the path of the yoga, the evolution of our life has been designedly led towards this turning point.
Isn't that one way of calling destiny?
You can call it destiny. As Sri Aurobindo will tell us many words for this. It is this very chapter. The Divine Master comes to us as a destiny. He comes to us as a gatekeeper. He has many forms in which he takes us to the destined goal, you might say. For now we begin to recognize, begin to understand the sense of our struggles and efforts, successes and failures. At last we are able to seize the meaning of our ordeals and sufferings and can appreciate the help that given, whether it was given us by all that hurt and resisted and the utility of our very falls and stumblings. When we fall, we complain. Why should I fall? But the Divine takes you through various kinds of paths of successes, of victories, of failures, of disasters, calamities, all kinds of methods. At that time we repel or we rejoice according to our immediate concern. But behind all that is the preparation of the paths. We recognize this divine leading afterwards, not retrospectively but immediately. Once you have gained this retrospective understanding of God's leading you, then you apply it even now. Earlier you were only trying to understand the Divine retrospectively. But now, once you have learned it, you can now apply the method now and say, even now what is happening to me, surely the Divine is present. So you should see in the present situation also how the Divine is present. Not retrospectively, but now itself. how the divine leading in the molding of our thoughts by a transcendent seer, of our will and actions by an all-embracing power, of our emotional life by an all-attracting and all-assimilating bliss and love. We recognize it too in a more personal relation that from the first touched us or at the last seizes us. We feel the eternal presence of a supreme master, friend, lover, teacher. These are the four terms which we recognize in the true teacher. He is a master, he is a friend, he is a lover, he is a teacher. That the teacher basically instructs. The lover attracts you with his love. The friend is a companion and gives you solace, gives you happiness, pleasure, gives you all kinds of play. But he is also the master. And that is the real recognition of the teacher as the master. It is he who commands everything and who has the authority of giving command to you. That's the mark of a teacher. A good teacher can tell you, do this, command with a complete responsibility. Whatever is to happen will happen. Do not grieve because I am in every circumstance. That is the master. He is sure, confident, infallible, can make no mistake. That is the mark of a master. A friend can make a mistake. Lover can make a mistake. Even teacher can make a mistake. But a master, he makes no mistake. When the teacher tells you authoritatively, he is a master. When the teacher explores with you, he is a teacher. But when he is authoritative, he is certain, that is the master. The Lord, the Divine, comes to us in our process of learning as a master, friend, lover, teacher. We recognize it in the essence of our being. As that develops into lifeness and oneness with a greater and wider existence. This is another mark of your entering into being. When you begin to become like your teacher, in your behavior, in your thinking, in your movements, in your seekings, a good teacher always has a power of creating imitation among the pupils. A good teacher becomes an example and the pupil begins to imitate, begins to become like the teacher. This is not the accumulation of more and more information. To become like your teacher, if your teacher is kind, you become kind. If your teacher is authoritative, you become authoritative. Your teacher is very friendly, you become very friendly. The teacher is very forgiving, you become very forgiving. The teacher is a seer, you become a seer. The teacher is your leader, you become a leader. Whenever you have a real growth of being, real knowledge, as distinguished from information, this is the special mark you will find. You do not only become more informed. Something happens to your very essence of your being. You are molded in the image of your teacher. We recognize it in the essence of our being as that develops into likeness and oneness with a greater and wider existence. For we perceive that this miraculous development is not the result of our own efforts. When you begin to become like your teacher, it is not your effort, it is He, because of the supreme attractiveness of His being, who mingles His being with your being, who wrestles and embraces your being, and then you become like Him. And then Sri Aurobindo gives a great statement, an eternal perfection is molding us into its own image. That is the mark of a great education. The true education is an eternal perfection molding us into its own image. We become perfect not by gaining lot of information. It is by becoming ourselves the likeness, the image of the Master Himself. And now Sri Aurobindo gives various ways by which we come to know this Master. By different names we call Him. One who is the Lord or Ishvara of the yogic philosophies. One who is the guide in the conscious being, Chaitya Guru or Antaryami. The absolute of the thinker, the unknowable of the agnostic, the universal force of the materialist, the supreme soul and the supreme Shakti, the one who is differently named and imaged by the religions, he is the master of our yoga. If you are a materialist, God comes to you as the force of matter. If you are an agnostic, then He comes to you in the form of the unknowable. If you are a yogi, He comes to you as the Ishvara. If you are a thinker, He comes to you as the absolute. In whatever form you are, He takes an appropriate form, but it is He who takes you in His hands. It is He who walks with you and trains you in His own mastery and makes you like Him. To see, to know, become and fulfill this one in our inner selves and in all our outer nature was always a secret goal and becomes now the conscious purpose of our embodied existence. If we are now in the real presence of the Master, we recognize what is the goal of our life. Our goal of life is actually nothing but to become like the Master of our being. The moment we begin to grow into His likeness, that is the reason why without the Guru you cannot have the real knowledge. Because what is knowledge is to be like the Master, to grow into the image of the Master. Therefore, unless you meet your Master, how can you be educated? The very aim of education, the very aim of life is to become like your teacher. Therefore, teacher becomes indispensable. To be conscious of Him in all parts of our being and equally in all that the dividing mind sees as outside our being is the consummation of the individual consciousness. To be possessed by Him and to possess Him in ourselves and in all things is a term of all empire and mastery. To enjoy Him in all experience of passivity and activity, of peace and of power, of unity and of difference, is the happiness which the jiva, the individual soul, manifested in the world, is obscurely seeking. This is the entire definition of the aim of integral yoga. It is the rendering in personal experience of the truths which the universal nature has hidden
in herself and which she travails to discover. It is the conversion of the human soul into the divine soul and of the natural life into divine living. This paragraph is so beautiful and so masterly that you should read this again and again. It's the entire definition of yoga, the entire aim of life, the entire thing that we are obscurely seeking and can be fulfilled only when this happens. As long as this does not happen, do not think that you have reached. There are many, many stages in which we are told the station, the destination has come. And if you want to be sure whether the destination has come or not, read this paragraph. See whether this has happened. To be conscious of Him, I am reading again, to be conscious of Him in all parts of our being and equally in all that the dividing mind sees as outside our being is the consummation of the individual consciousness. To be possessed by Him and possess Him in ourselves and in all things is the term of all empire and mastery. To enjoy Him in all experience of passivity and activity, of peace and of power, of unity and of difference, is the happiness with the jiva, the individual soul manifested in the world, is obscurely seeking. This is the entire definition of the aim of integral yoga. It is a rendering in personal experience of the truths which universal nature has hidden in herself and which she travails to discover. It is the conversion of the human soul into the divine soul and of natural life into divine living. This is only the introduction so far of the divine teacher. Now we go forward and look at this divine teacher in our world. The surest way towards this integral fulfillment is to find the master of the secret who dwells within us. Open ourselves constantly to the divine power, which is also the divine wisdom and love, and trust to it to effect the conversion. But it is difficult for the egoistic consciousness to do this at all at the beginning. And if done at all, it is still difficult to do it perfectly. And in every strand of our nature, it is difficult at first because our egoistic habits of thought, of sensation, of feeling block up the avenues by which we can arrive at the perception that is needed. It is difficult afterwards because the faith, the surrender, the courage requisite in this path are not easy to the ego-clouded soul. The divine working is not the working which the egoistic mind desires or approves. For it uses error in order to arrive at truth, suffering in order to arrive at bliss, imperfection in order to arrive at perfection. The ego cannot see where it is being led. It revolts against the leading, loses confidence, loses courage. These failings would not matter, for the divine guide within is not offended by our revolt, not discouraged by our want of faith or repelled by our weaknesses. He has the entire love of the mother and the entire patience of the teacher. But by withdrawing our assent from the guidance, we lose the consciousness, though not all the actuality, not in any case the eventuality of its benefits. And we withdraw our assent because we fail to distinguish our higher self from the lower,
through which he is preparing his self-revelation. As in the world, so in ourselves. We cannot see God because of his workings, and especially because he works in us through our nature and not by a succession of arbitrary miracles. Man demands miracles that he may have faith. He wishes to be dazzled in order that he may see. And this impatience, this ignorance may turn into a great danger and disaster if in our revolt against the divine dealing, we call in another distorting force more satisfying to our impulses and desires and ask it to guide us and give it the divine name. The difficulty of discovering the divine master. This is what Sri Aurobindo describes to us. Why is it we cannot discover the master, the divine master, who is within us? Sri Aurobindo gives us the analysis. First, it is difficult at first. You see in the first 7th line on the top of this paragraph, it is difficult at first because our egoistic habits of thought, of sensation, of feeling block up the avenues by which you can arrive at the perception that is needed. Egoistic habits of thought. What is the egoistic habit of thought? Habit means what? A constant turn towards what has already been established. That is a habit. A constant turn. We habitually smile when we meet people who come to meet us. It's a habitual. It's a constant turn. It is established and somebody comes to meet us, we greet. It is a habitual movement of our greeting. Similarly, there are many other kinds of habits. It's only one good example. But there are many other bad examples also of habits. When somebody praises you, habitually we like it. It is our habit to like a praise. It is our actual habit, egoistic habit, to dislike blame. It's a habitual way. If somebody blames you, immediately you withdraw. It's a habit of the ego. I cannot have done wrong. Because of our habitual way of thinking, we cannot see when the divine comes to us. He may come to us not in a very agreeable form. He may come to us blaming you, and you may not like him. So you may not recognize him, that, oh, he is my master. The master who is within you may come to you in many ways which are opposed to your egoistic ways of thinking. Our egoistic habits of thought, of sensation, of feeling. We think habitually, we sense habitually, we feel habitually. And they are all egoistic in normal turn of our consciousness. That is why we don't recognize the master when he comes. It is difficult afterwards because the faith, the surrender, the courage requisite in the path are not easy to the ego-clouded soul. If you don't have the faith, enough faith in the leading of the master, and then master says, now you proceed. But the faith is not there, therefore we give up. We don't move forward. Surrender is not there, therefore we do not move forward.
The courage is not there, therefore we don't move forward. These are the blockades as to why we cannot recognize the Master and cannot allow Him to work in our life. The ego cannot see where it is being led. It revolts against the leading, loses confidence, loses courage. But the Divine Master therefore does not leave you. Because you do not follow His leading, He is not offended. He continues in His own way, even through your revolts, even through your loss of courage or of faith, He continues because He is deeply interested in you, even more interested than we may be interested in Him, because He knows who you are and what you are and why you are. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, the Divine Guide within us is not offended by our revolt. He is not discouraged by our want of faith or repelled by our weakness. He has the entire love of the Mother and the entire patience of the Teacher. But by withdrawing our assent from the guidance, we lose the consciousness, though not all the actualities, not in any case the eventuality of its benefits. As we withdraw our assent, and we withdraw our assent because we fail to distinguish our higher self from the lower, through which is preparing His self-revelation. As in the world, so in ourselves, we cannot see God because of His workings, and especially because He works in us through our nature, and not by a succession of arbitrary miracles. It's a very special method of God. We want to see miracles to believe in God, but God precisely does not do it, because He wants to prepare your nature. If only miracles happen, your nature will not be trained. You will not be able to see, even in the leaf of a tree, the miracle of God, because it is so familiar. You will see only, in a miracle you will see God, but not in the leaves, in the ordinary ripple of a river, in a smile of a child. All these are very familiar, very small things in life. And this is what God wants to tell you. Not only in extraordinary events He is present, but even in ordinary events, God is everywhere, omnipresent. It is that which He wants to teach you, so why should He do miracles? He doesn't teach you by a succession of arbitrary miracles. Man demands miracles that he may have faith. He wishes to be dazzled in order that he may see. One day a disciple went to the Mother and said, Mother, so many teachers are doing so many miracles. Why don't you give miracles to the people? So she said, what miracle do you want to see? Shall I bring a tree here? A big tree, shall I bring it here before you? Even if that happens, you will not believe it. So many miracles have happened in the world. The people have to be trained to see God in every event. Why only a miracle? Every event is a miracle if you want to see the miracles. What is happening to you now is a miracle. Reading of this book itself is a miracle. If you really consider the events and the situation of life, if you just want to see the cause and effect relationship, the very fact that these words come to us now is a miracle. We are impatient, and this impatience, this ignorance, may turn into a great danger and disaster. Don't therefore demand miracles. Miracles in any case will happen. Not that there are no miracles. Miracles are what? The entrance of a higher principle into a lower principle is miracle. In a lower working, when a higher working begins to operate, is a miracle. If with your physical eyes you can see an invisible being, it's a miracle. The invisible being is a higher principle. Your eyes are trained only to see the physical thing. If your physical things begin to see the invisible, it's a miracle. This is actually what ought to happen every time, every moment, because invisible exists. And your eyes are capable of seeing, only it is not trained. But when necessary, the divine also gives you miracles. It is not as if he denies miracles. But does not follow your egoistic demand of miracle, because then he will not be a good teacher. If he follows your egoistic demand and says, now show me miracles, then I'll believe you. He is not in a hurry at all that you should believe in him. He has a greater purpose. He wants to show you miracles in everyday life, in every moment. What Arjuna saw in Sri Krishna in the battlefield is one of the greatest miracles, in fact. The 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita you should read sometime. How Sri Krishna manifests the divinity in a great splendor, as if thousand suns were blazing at once in the sky. That is how Arjuna describes the vision of Sri Krishna, as if thousand suns had suddenly risen in the sky. That also can happen. But Sri Krishna, before starting his teaching, he didn't say, now look, I'm a miraculous God and what I have to tell you, you should obey. No. He took the disciple little by little by little through difficult process of understanding. It is only when he had already a faith in him, not to create faith in him, already when he had a faith in him, that that great miracle happened and he saw the Supreme Divine in physical form. So if divine does a miracle, it is not because he wants to create faith in you. For a specific purpose, he can always do it. But to show miracle is not the sign of the master. The sign of the master is that he shows you miracle even in those things which are familiar. When he makes you train that you see God in everything. I see you and I see God. That is a miracle. But human beings sometimes are impatient. When God does not show you the miracle, but some ordinary man show you the miracle, and you turn away from God and you go to the ordinary man, that is a disaster. Therefore, Sri Aurobindo says, don't be impatient. Don't be dazzled. Don't have this demand for miracles. This impatience, this ignorance may turn into a great danger and disaster if, in our revolt against the divine leading, we call in another distorting force, more satisfying to our impulses and desires, and ask it to guide us and give it the divine name. But while it is difficult for man to believe in something unseen within himself, it is easy for him to believe in something which he can image as extraneous to himself. Now Sri Aurobindo brings us to that argument as to why human beings need human teachers. Although divine teacher is always there within us, and therefore we can do without a human teacher. Why is it necessary that we do need human teachers? This is because while it is difficult for man to believe in something unseen within himself, it is easy for him to believe in something which he can image as extraneous to himself. The spiritual progress of most human beings demands
an extraneous support, an object of faith outside us. It needs an external image of God, or it needs a human representative, incarnations, prophet or guru. Or it demands both and receives them. For according to the need of the human soul, the divine manifests himself as deity, as human divine, or in simple humanity. Using that thick disguise, we so successfully conceal the Godhead for a means of transmission of his guidance. That is why the Hindu discipline of spirituality provides for this need of the soul by the conceptions of the Ishta Devata, the Avatar, and the Guru. These are only ladders, crutches. When we need a human teacher, and Divine comes to you also as a human teacher, He even provides you a human teacher. Because it is easier for the human being to approach the Divine outwardly instead of inwardly. That is why in India particularly it is said that if you do not find the Divine teacher within you, find a human teacher and approach him and treat him as a Divine teacher. Treat him. Because even if the human teacher is inadequate, he has imperfections in him, the Divine teacher will come to you because you want to meet him. And Divine takes a human instrument. Even if he's defective, the Divine fulfills the defects and presents to you, as far as you are concerned, he presents himself as a perfect Divine. The human teacher himself may be imperfect, but because the Divine teacher uses him as his representative, because you choose him, therefore his defects are blurred, obliterated, cancelled by the Divine when he deals with you. It is also like a doctor. The doctor himself may not be capable, but if you go to the doctor and pray to the Divine, please act through him, then the doctor will immediately be transfigured into that divinity and will treat you as a Divine would treat you. This is the miracle, you might say. How the human person approaches a teacher, he becomes for you the Divine himself. And that is why in India, this discipline has been cultivated for ages, thousands of years. In fact, it is said that everybody, even if he has found God within him, he should still go to a human teacher. It is so much embedded in the Indian culture. And that is a seeking for a human teacher, one in whom you can see the Divine, or at least you find the Ishta Devata. Now this conception of Ishta Devata is very important. There is God himself, there are many gods, and there are number of human beings. God himself is the Divine, God is also Divine, human beings also are Divine. In the eyes of integrality, there is nothing which is not divine. And yet, there are limitations. The human beings are very limited, gods are not so limited, and God is fully unlimited. You may not find a human teacher in whom you may see very many human defects, therefore you may not be able to approach him. Then you approach a deity, a god. India recognizes the presence of gods.
There are gods.
And each god has a special quality. And each one of us vibrates with this quality or that quality. According to your vibration, the god of a particular vibration becomes more favorable to you. He is nearer to you. He is more like you, because ultimately you have to become like God himself. So any god who seems to be like you, he becomes your favorite god, Ishta Devata. If you are in a hurry of transformation, if you are extremely devoted to transformation, you will automatically find Shiva as your favorite deity, Ishta Devata. Because Shiva is the impetuous power of transformation. If you are very intolerant of your defects, if you don't want your defects at all, then you will find Shiva is your very favorite. Because he does not tolerate any defect. In his presence, no defects can be present. To get Shiva with you is the most difficult thing. Because you should be prepared to throw away all your defects at once. If you want charming smile of the divine, then Mahalakshmi will always become your favorite. She does not see your defects. She does not want to remove your defects. She only wants to attract you, to uplift you, to fondle you. And if you need to be fondled, Mahalakshmi will become your favorite deity. If you are a patient laborer, a good student, a good worker, Saraswati will become your favorite deity. You will always turn to her. You will like her very much because in your being there is a vibration of Saraswati. So this idea of favorite deity is not a wrong idea. It's a very effective and powerful and correct, true idea. The divine has many forms. And you can take any form which is appropriate to your nature and climb up the ladder. Only you should not agree to limit yourself to this or that or that. You take the help, take the ladder, and then go beyond, because ultimate, he is the supreme divine that you have to meet. So you may take the human teacher, you may take God as Ishta Devata. But ultimately you have to find out the Lord within ourselves. That is the real aim of the integral yoga. Even if you are a human guru, ultimately you have to discover the Lord himself within you. The Hindu discipline of spirituality provides for this need of the soul by the conceptions of Ishta Devata. Ishta means that which is desired, that which is liked, admired, the Sanskrit word. Ish is the word of Icha. The word Icha comes from Ish. That which is desired, that which is favored by you, your favorite god. That is Ishta Devata, the avatar and the guru. By Ishta Devata, the chosen deity is meant not some inferior power, but a name and form of the transcendent and universal Godhead. Almost all religions either have at their base or make use of some such name and form of the divine. Its necessity for the human soul is evident. God is the all and more than the all. But that which is more than all than the all, how shall man conceive? And even the all is at first too hard for him. For he himself, in his active consciousness, is a limited and selective formation, and can open himself only to that which is in harmony with his limited nature. There are things in the all which are too hard for his comprehension, or seem too terrible to his sensitive emotions and cowering sensations. Or simply, he cannot conceive as the divine, cannot approach or cannot recognize something that is too much out of the circle of his ignorant and partial conceptions. It is necessary for him to conceive God in his own image. This is now the other way around. In the true learning, you become like God. That is the ultimate course of action. But in the beginning, you like God to be like you. Not yourself becoming like God, but you like that, or that form of God which is like you. And if you turn more easily to that aspect of the divine which is more like you. There is a very difficult word in English, anthropomorphism. You should try to pronounce this word also. Anthropomorphism. To make God in the image of man is anthropomorphism. To think of God as if he is a human being, regarding him as a human being, because human beings are pleased when you praise them, and therefore you approach God to praise him, so that he may be pleased with you, is anthropomorphic. We believe that just as human beings are pleased by flattery, God also is pleased by flattery. Which is not true, but it is to look upon God as if he is a human being. Because when you strike somebody and then you feel that now he will take revenge against me, similarly you revolt against God and you believe that now God will take revenge against me. God will not like me. God will be now offended. He does not know that God is never offended. That is the divine. As Sri Aurobindo says, God is not offended by our revolts. He is like a mother. He understands your revolts. And even in your revolt, he comes to you and embraces you. But that requires a higher knowledge of the divine. Otherwise, normally we think, if I now revolt against God, God will go away from me. He'll be offended. But he's not offended. So to image God in man's image, that is anthropomorphism. But even that has a use, because God uses everything. Every method of man is used by God for his purposes. So this idea of looking upon divine in the form in which we like him, God also takes that form. If you like a certain form of God and say, well, I like this very much, then God takes that form also and treats you through that. It is necessary for him to conceive God in his own image or in some form that is beyond himself but consonant with his highest tendencies and seizable by his feeling or his intelligence. Otherwise, it would be difficult for him to come into contact and communion with the divine. So even anthropomorphism has uses. You start with it, ultimately you will come to God himself and then throw away anthropomorphism. Even then, his nature calls for a human intermediary so that he may feel the divine in something entirely close to his own humanity and sensible in a human influence and example. So even Ishta Devata may not be enough. A God who is very near to you, even that may not be enough for you to approach God. So you may come to a human form. That is why the human guru is needed. Even then his nature calls for a human intermediary, so that he may feel the divine in something entirely close to his own humanity and sensible in a human influence and example. This call is satisfied by the divine manifest in a human appearance. The incarnation, the avatar, Krishna, Christ, Buddha. Or if this is too hard for him to conceive, the divine represents himself through a less marvelous intermediary, prophet or teacher. For many who cannot conceive or are unwilling to accept the divine man, are ready to open themselves to the supreme man, terming him not incarnation, but world teacher or divine representative. This also is not enough. A living influence, a living example, a present instruction is needed. So you may have Ishta Devata, or you may have incarnation as a great being who lived in physical, but as an incarnation. Even that may not be enough. You may have a teacher, a prophet. But a prophet of the past may not be enough. You need sometimes even a living teacher, one who can talk to you physically, one who can, you can see him living day after day. A living influence, a living example, a present instruction is needed. For it is only the few who can make the past teacher and his teaching, the past incarnation and his example and influence, a living force in their lives. For this need also, the Hindu discipline provides in the relation of the guru and the disciple. The guru may sometimes be the incarnation or world teacher, as Arjuna found in Krishna, as is a living teacher. And it so happened that Krishna was not only a human teacher, but he was also incarnation. The guru may sometimes be incarnation or world teacher, but it is sufficient that he should represent to the disciple the divine wisdom, convey to him something of the divine ideal, or make him feel the realized relation of the human soul with the eternal. He may not be a great prophet. He may not be a great incarnation. If the teacher can give him the knowledge of the divine, can take him to the experience of the divine, even that is enough. And even that should be provided for. The sadhaka of the integral yoga will make use of all these aids according to his nature. There is nothing that is denied in the integral yoga. You can worship a human teacher who may not be a great incarnation. You can worship a teacher who is incarnation or a prophet, either of the present day or of the past. Or you can go to a god, Ishta Devata, favored god or goddess. Or you go directly to the supreme teacher himself within yourself. Any and all, everything is admitted in the integral yoga. The sadhaka of the integral yoga will make use of all these aids according to his nature. But it is necessary that he should shun their limitations and cast from himself that exclusive tendency of egoistic mind which cries, my God, my incarnation, my prophet, my guru. This is the evil
which should be avoided.
You may love your teacher, but you say, oh, my teacher is the only teacher in the world and none other. My prophet is the only prophet in the world. This exclusiveness, the Supreme God is the only God, the one without the second. All other forms are secondary forms, and we should take them all in their supreme light. It is necessary that he should shun their limitations and cast from himself that exclusive tendency of egoistic mind which cries, my God, my incarnation, my prophet, my guru, and opposes it all to all other realizations in a sectarian or a fanatical spirit. All sectarianism, all fanaticism must be shunned, for it is inconsistent with the integrity of the divine realization. There's a beautiful prayer of Sri Aurobindo where he prays to all the gods and he says, now liberate me from all the gods. I think we stop here today, huh? Thank you.